Hello, everybody out there. This is another episode of Discussions with David, which has been happening pretty regularly now for quite a while on Wednesdays and occasionally other days as well at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, and goes out. We're going out right now live on the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio, as well as the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and my own Facebook, Twitch, Twitter, and with YouTube pages. And this is all archived. If you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find this in podcast form shortly after it goes out live in video form. And we're spending the hour now with a wonderful historian and longtime friend and author, Jeremy Brecker, who has written a book recently published on PM Press, along with many of his other books, which have been published on PM Press, Common Preservation in an Age of Mutual Destruction. We're going to talk about that and other subjects. And Jeremy, it's great to have you back on my little show. This book is wonderful. And I mean, it strikes me that there's been, first of all, there's been a number of really good people writing sort of handbooks on organizing lately. And I guess that's not a new phenomenon, writing such books, but it seems like a lot of people I know have been writing books kind of that are exploring the toolkits for how to do good organizing and avoid pitfalls. And I don't know if this is happening more recently, lately than it used to, but there's been a lot of good books coming out. And this book is another of a series. And it's also another in a series that you've written that is exploring this theme of, I mean, you're either often writing history books about history or books examining how history, or the combination of books about history or books that are examining how history happened and why and how it might go differently if we were to learn from what just happened. But I'm summarizing in ham-handed ways here maybe, but I want to start way back. I mean, I'm just, as I was reading this book, I was, one of the things that I was thinking of was how I'm actually reminded of the SDS's Port Huron statement, in terms of just the feeling of the re-examining recent history and not taking things for granted. And would you say that there is this ongoing 60 years of a common theme here going on here?
Absolutely. And I was not at Port Huron, but I joined SDS within a year afterwards, and it was a very, very formative document as well as life period for me.
You were 15, I believe, when that was written.
I believe so. Yeah. They're about 62. So.
Oh, okay. So you were 17. I'm doing the math here.
But I think that the awareness is very interesting now, because generational awareness in the context of climate change is so important today. The feeling that many, many young people have, that they have been abandoned by adults to a world that is about to destroy their future, is because of global warming and climate change. A very, very reasonable and appropriate feeling, in my view of the things. And we had a very similar situation in the early 60s, where the threat of nuclear holocaust, the Cold War, and the likelihood, as many of my generation understood, that we would have a nuclear war that would be the destruction on the kind of level that we now perceive climate change as bringing, perhaps a little more slowly, but even more certainly, and that the adults were simply not taking responsibility for dealing with this, and that young people who are going to live in that future had to step in and take action. And,
it was a very similar feeling. When you were young, you were born into a world where you were, when you were born, that was when the nuclear bombs were first used by humans on other humans. And so there's the context that you're coming into the world in, right?
At the end of the
Nazi Holocaust and the use of the first use of nuclear weapons. And here you go.
I was born less than a year before Hiroshima. In my family kitchen, we had instructions for what to do, a poster of what to do in the event of nuclear attack. And my family had family meetings in which we discussed, people had read the book Hiroshima by John Hersey, which described what actually happened to ordinary human beings in the bombing of Hiroshima. And one of the things that happens is families were separated, and we made a plan for how, if there was a nuclear attack and we lived just outside of New York City, any of us who survived would try to make our way to Canada, where there was a family that we knew, and we would try to reassemble there. So this was very, very serious and taken as a very real possibility. Actually, it's little known, because there are a lot of myths about this, but one of the major reasons we did not have a nuclear holocaust, although certainly the threat is still there and remains powerful and perhaps getting worse as a new arms race heats up, but we are still here and we didn't have a nuclear holocaust. And a major reason for that is because of the peace movement and the nuclear disarmament movement, which was believed at the time, even by participants, to be largely futile and really didn't accomplish anything. But when historians went back over the record and got the secret archives of government leaders in the United States and elsewhere, it turns out that they were petrified about the peace movement, that they were manipulating and maneuvering all over the place to try to avoid its impact or to mislead it. And in the end, they actually agreed to an 80% reduction in strategic nuclear arms in the strategic weapons test. The nuclear arms, nuclear testing ban, and numerous other agreements and policy changes, Russia and the United States agreeing to stop aiming their weapons at each other on a hair trigger basis. Overwhelmingly, not 100%, but overwhelmingly a reaction to the pressure and leaders' fear of the peace movement.
So it's so important to observe, isn't it? I mean, because it's so easy to be really just dismissive of the peace movement, or to feel like what's been accomplished. We still have tens of thousands of nuclear warheads in the world pointed at each other. But as you say, they haven't been used since Nagasaki and on other humans, and at least not on cities. And this is quite an accomplishment. And then when you actually know what politicians have actually written and said to each other, and how things have gone down in terms of how they've responded to the peace movement, as like Nixon and everybody else, I mean, this is it's real, and it had a real impact. But they always want to dismiss the impact of social movements, don't they? I mean, and make sure we don't think that it had any particular impact. I mean, we're always, in so many ways, we're led to believe these things don't work, right?
That's exactly right. And it's a lesson that we should keep in mind in the era of climate change and the movement against climate change, because again, leaders are saying, national leaders and corporate leaders are saying, well, we understand climate change and we're the ones that are going to take steps. They used to deny it, but now, and that was very much true also in the nuclear era, where it was like, oh, we have this all under control. This isn't a threat. We'll just build enough nuclear weapons to keep anyone from being able to attack us effectively. And eventually, after a lot of people being taken in by that, eventually enormous numbers of people in this country and around the world came to the conclusion that that was a lot of hogwash and that they personally were threatened and their children and their families' future were threatened by the nuclear policies being pursued by governments. And it was at that point that the pressure for making at least some steps toward nuclear disarmament and arms control became irresistible, and the governments decided to go along. I think we're facing a very, very similar moment now with climate change. After the widespread denial that climate change was real or that there was anything soon that was going to happen, and we could really leave this for 100 or 200 years for people in the future to worry about, that has finally, I think that that particular ice jam has broken, and now it's almost more like panic that people have. And so you're getting world leaders saying, oh, climate change is a terrible threat, and that's why we're taking these dramatic moves. We've agreed to cut carbon. Well, not this year.
And that's why we need to bomb some country, right? When is it going to happen that they're going to say climate change is such a threat that we need to invade and destroy this country? I mean, when are they going to use that as a pretext for imperialism, right? But this, it is there in the course of the arms race and the Cold War, as they call it, there was a point where the leadership kind of realized where mutually assured destruction became sort of a doctrine. Whereas was there sort of a point where that happened? And is that kind of like what you're saying? We're kind of like at this point where the leaders are realizing, oh, we really are in for it here. This is not working.
Yes, definitely. And but before the leaders recognized it, the people recognized it.
Yeah.
I remember when Barry Goldwater ran for president with the idea of why can't we use these nuclear weapons if we have them? And his slogan was of his followers was, in your heart, you know he's right. Being a pun on right meaning correct and right meaning right wing, to which the widespread, there wasn't Facebook and Twitter, but the word could still spread in those days. And the word that spread was, in your heart, you know he's nuts. And that became a very widespread feeling about that kind of, let's unleash our nuclear power. Similarly, the building of fallout shelters, which was supposed to reassure the American people that they didn't have to worry about a nuclear war because they could just go underground for a couple of weeks, probably did more than any other single thing to persuade the American public that the people who were leading them into the nuclear arms race and into, as the title of my book says, mutual destruction,
were completely mad.
Were just crazy. And they said, we're going to, if they think we can survive nuclear holocaust by going underground for a couple of weeks in our fallout shelters, we're not going there. And that really had a huge impact. And we see very much the same thing today in the climate issue, where people say, well, we'll build, there is some problem with flooding. You know, we know that some cities have had some floods and hurricanes, but we'll just build dikes and dams outside in the ocean outside the city. And that's how we'll deal with it. And other forms of what they call adaptation will protect us from the threat of climate change. We don't really have to do anything about the causes of climate change. We don't have to stop burning for fossil fuels. Or there's another version of this, which is, well, we'll just suck the carbon and the other greenhouse gases out of the smokestacks. It's called carbon capture. And therefore, we'll control climate change that way. Or even weirder are the people who say, well, we'll just suck it out of the air. We'll put it into the air through the smokestacks and the tailpipes. And then we'll get some machines that will separate the carbon from the rest of the atmosphere and pull it back out, and we'll bury it somewhere. Very, very similar in the mentality, if you think about it, to the fallout shelters. But we should keep in mind that, again, there's a real chance that ordinary folks will look at this and say, in your heart, you know they're nuts.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can you explain, Jeremy, what I mean? It's mentioned so much in the course of your thinking and writing in this book in particular. What's the difference between a heuristic and a theory?
Well, it's a good question, and I partially...
If it's esoteric, it's an important question anyway, because it comes, many times in the book.
I will say a little about it, but I partially made the decision not to talk about theory because many people, and to some extent I'm included, have a kind of allergy to theory, because the kinds of theory that were presented, first of all, tends to be very abstract. It tends to be, we think of theory as opposed to our personal experience and our collective experience, and we think of it as disconnected from practice. It's that kind of knowledge that people sitting in the ivory tower produce without its having any connection to what ordinary folks might do with it. Now, there's lots of theory that this is a slander of and that this doesn't apply to, but I think many, many people, they have a kind of allergic reaction to the term. So that's one reason I chose not to use it. But there's another much more important one, and the reason I use the term heuristic, because I don't think we can have all the answers to the things we need to do, the problems that we're addressing, and how to go about addressing them as something in a preconceived theory that's apart from our what we learn as we go forward and try actually dealing with it and then draw lessons and try again. And that's the idea of a heuristic. A heuristic is just a Latin name word for a method to find things out. And so what I tried to do in this book is not lay out a theory that'll say, if you do X, then Y will happen, and then you will have a Z on your hands, and then what you should do is A, and so on and so forth. Not a cut and dried solution. I put forward some ideas about possible actions, but always tentatively and always with the idea that, okay, well, I'm putting out something, but now other people need to think critically about it, see if they can tweak it, find the parts that are wrong, see what they can improve in it, and then try to figure out how to apply it, and then look and see what were the results. And where it didn't work out right, go back to the drawing boards and tweak it again and correct it, and then test it again. So it's a whole process, and really at the core of the common preservation heuristic is that idea of we develop the best understanding and the best plans for action that we can, and then we try them out, and then we sometimes the term is used as feedback, sometimes it's just learning, but we learn or we take the feedback from that and revisit it, reevaluate it, and say, okay, what do we need to learn from this, and how are we going to change our actions and change our plan and change our understanding of the situation in such a way that then we can make another and better effort. And I actually, in the final section of Common Preservation in an Age of Mutual Destruction, apply this to the climate protection movement and give a little history of the climate protection movement and show how it went through a number of stages in which it changed quite radically in response to what worked and what didn't work in the previous efforts. And so, for example, and I'll just give one example of that many, that series of changes and developments, but it was very much focused on education and lobbying and those kinds of activities, which were good and necessary, but not sufficient. And eventually a lot of people in the climate movement said, no, we got to do something else here. And the prime result was the struggle against the Keystone XL pipeline, which was developed specifically in order to take the climate movement to another level and to directly confront the fossil fuel companies and the forces that were, we might call the friends of fossil fuel, and create a situation where people would be forced to confront and recognize that drawing on the idea of Martin Luther King, that there's a way in which nonviolence may seem namby-pamby to some people, but actually it's a way of creating tensions in a community that forces people to confront the things that they're trying to run away from and pretend aren't going on. And the Keystone XL pipeline had a transformative effect, both on the climate movement, but beyond that, on the politics of climate change everywhere from local city councils and local energy policy process, all the way to the fact that the first thing on his first day of office that Joe Biden did was to cancel the permit for the KXL pipeline after years and years of struggle. So you can't stop climate change by stopping one pipeline, but it's also true that you can learn from that there's a transformative effect when large numbers of people go and draw the line on what they're willing to accept and find a way to express that through sitting down at the White House, which is something that I did at the beginning of that process, or locking themselves to the machines that are clearing the way for the pipeline, or all kinds of outreach in communities and education in association with that. These kinds of movements have a power, which, as you said earlier, those in authority try to deny and try to persuade us isn't there. But I would say the ultimate blocking and halting of the KXL pipeline would be another example of how that's a fraud that they're trying to perpetrate on us.
Mm. And part of why it's so important to write about the power that social movements can have and have had is to illustrate how this can work, and because they want us to believe the powers that be that these things don't work. But at the same time, another important reason to write about this stuff is because it's to try to avoid or help us all collectively avoid going down the various pitfalls that can lead to things not working out. And I wonder if you can talk about some of that, like what are some of the tendencies that you would identify that are ones that are that we're trying to not fall into, which you write about as well.
Well, the first thing I'd say about that is it really depends on concrete situations, and something that's a good idea in one situation may be a bad idea in another situation.
So important, right?
Well, the first thing is you have to look around. You can't just say X worked or Y didn't work in some other situation. It's a very good idea to take another situation and say, what was there going on there that we can learn from and try to apply it to the situation you're in. But it's also very important to look at the similarities and the differences in the situations. I think that's part of the central role of history and maybe perhaps also of the kind of heuristic that I try to present, because the heuristic is about what kinds of, when people talk about heuristic questions, what are the kinds of questions you need to ask? I'm trying to think of a good example of an answer to your question, and there's lots of them.
There's so many.
There's so many
potential ones. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. Certainly, the actually, can we come back to that? Let me think about it for a minute, because it's a very, very good question, but it's not one that I have an answer on the tip of my tongue.
Absolutely. Jeremy, you and a lot of other people who have written books trying to illustrate the great examples of mutual aid and transformation of societies and people coming together in massive and remarkable ways. People often come back to the Reconstruction period after the American Civil War, when the Southern states were occupied by the Union Army, which of course Du Bois wrote Black Reconstruction about, which Howard Fast wrote the wonderful novel Freedom Road about, and one of the chapters in your book is titled Freedom Road, and you talk about that period. And I think, you know, for just for those who are not familiar with it, can you talk about Reconstruction and what was going on then, and why it's such an important example to talk about when we're talking about social movements and what they can accomplish?
Actually, the first content chapter in Common Preservation is about exactly that question. And it tells how when I was a young person, definitely in my teens, I came across the book you mentioned, Freedom Road by Howard Fast, which is a novel about the way in which former slaves, after the Civil War, organized themselves, became a political force. It has one fictional character who actually became a major political leader. And although he's fictional, there were a number of former slaves who became congressional representatives from the South and played a big role in the state legislatures in that what was called the Reconstruction period. And so, having read that novel and been very moved by it, I was told by an African-American sociologist who happened to be passing through the town that I lived in, you should go read the real thing about what really happened. It's a book by W.E.B. Du Bois called Black Reconstruction. I recommend it to anyone. It was a book that was largely ignored at the time that it was written and is now regarded widely as the font of wisdom and the starting place for studies of the Reconstruction period. And what he uncovered was that there was a massive self-organization by former slaves. In fact, many of it started from the period that the slaves, African-American enslaved people, were still enslaved on the plantations. And as he said, they looked and listened and tried to find out what was going on. And as soon as they found out that they wouldn't just be shot or arrested or sent back to their owners by the Union troops, they began migrating to the Union lines and became a major force, first as workers, and then eventually, as the war became tougher and tougher, the North, the Union forces, Abraham Lincoln and Congress, decided that they had to allow the Black workers to become soldiers, and they became a major force, military force in the Civil War, and were poised to become an even greater military force at the point that the South surrendered. Du Bois's description of this, he calls a general strike, that first of all the enslaved black workforce, they had always found ways to try to resist overwork and put some kind of limit on the demands on them for work. They took those and began what was sort of he calls it a general strike. It also could be called a general slowdown, and just refused to turn out the crops and the other goods that were needed for the Southern war effort. And then progressively moved to go to the Union lines, offer their labor there, and then offer their ability as soldiers. So that whole process involved a movement from people who were isolated on rural plantations, totally dominated by the direct power of slave owners and their minions in the state militias and patrols and so on, and moving through a process from that to a point where they became an organized force and eventually a major organized force in reshaping the South. And it took the Ku Klux Klan and the entire mobilization of a alliance between Northern capital and Southern plantation owners to militarily suppress the power that had been developed by the black workforce.
And that power that had been developed, I mean, like, just to give some kind of a picture of it, Jeremy, like, I mean, because there's a lot of people watching this who have been involved with mutual aid projects all over the U.S. and other countries and in 2020. But like, and when we're talking about mutual aid at that time, I mean, you're talking about what, like over 1,000 plantations being taken over by multiracial groups of former slaves and former tenant farmers and forming collectives. And I mean, the kind of stuff that was going on was just epic, huh?
The anybody who wants to know more about that, I suggest two things. One is do read Black Reconstruction by W.E.B. Du Bois. It's a good read. But also look at the works of Eric Foner on Reconstruction. There's a series of them. And he has basically gone back over this ground and found tremendous amounts of additional material that wasn't available to Du Bois. For example, he found records in most of the southern states with capsule biographies of the black political figures who became state legislators, and many, many other things. So gives an even more full description. Among the things that they did was, first of all, create what was called universal manhood suffrage, that is, slaves and African, former slaves, the African-American male population. No women had a legal right to vote at this point, but all men, black and white, were enfranchised, and an education system, public free education system, was created for the first time for both blacks and whites throughout the South. And those were major accomplishments. And for more, see Eric Foner and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Jeremy, you write about Jean Piaget and what an impact Piaget had on your thinking early on. I wonder if you could, and which might come as a surprise to some people who, you know, if they know who that is, then they think of child psychology. But can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is one of the things that people are most likely to be surprised about in the book. And I got into it kind of in a backward way, just having people mention Piaget. I actually took a class on Marx's Capital, and in trying to explain explain Marx's ideas of development, the teacher said, well, you know, modern theory of development, something that's very like Piaget's is, like Marx's is Jean Piaget's. And I thought, I better find out about that, although it seemed very surprising. But the gist of the basic idea, first of all, what is development? Development is when we learn or create the capacity to do something that we weren't able to do before. They're actually, most theories of change and writing about change either assumes that there's some great leader who makes the change that, you know, leads people to act in a different way, or it assumes that there's some cause. People were starving, and that's why they started doing something new in a very mechanical way. But we know that people starve all the time and don't make radical change, don't make social movements, don't make revolutions. So it can't be that simple. And yet we also know that people do form movements and do engage in all kinds of collective action when before they weren't acting collectively, they were very, very isolated, as in the case that we talked about of enslaved people on plantations in the South during the Civil War. So Piaget's focus is how does an infant who is not whose activity is not organized, they may be able to move an arm or they may be able to look at something, but they're not able to look at something and then move their arm in such a way that they can reach out and grasp it. That kind of coordination. And his life work was devoted to trying to figure out how people, whether they're infants, and then he also goes on and applies this to more developed forms of thought, including even scientific thought. But how do people change and how do they develop new ways of thinking? And at the core of it was, it's neither just an inborn thing that they, well, when they're little, they move their arm, and then through some change in their genes or their brain cells that they don't have anything to do with, they become smart, wise, functioning adults. So it's not, but it's also not just because they're taught. It's not just because something is imposed on them from outside, and that's why they make it. That's why they change and learn. So what he came up with as the basis for how this change happens is it happens through action. It happens through people have whatever their current thing. If it's the infant that moves its arm and thrashes its arm around, and maybe accidentally it touches the something it's looking at, and it thinks, maybe I could coordinate the thing I'm looking at and what I'm doing with my arm. And of course, he makes an infinitely more elaborated version of that through dozens and dozens and dozens of volumes, each one more turgent than the preceding one. But you'll find, fortunately, a summary of what's relevant to the questions that we're talking about today in my book, Common Preservation. But the basic, what I took from this is people are, they have patterns, and we all know that they're, people are kind of locked into their patterns, but they run into a problem, some kind of gap in what they're trying to do, between some kind of gap between what they're trying to do, what they want to do, and what they're actually accomplishing. And here we get back to that idea that we started out this whole conversation with about feedback or learning, the process by which people act and then they look at the results of their action and draw conclusions about what worked and what didn't work and what might improve it for the next round. And that is the core idea that Piaget lays out for how development happens, how people are able to move from a pattern that they're stuck in to some new kind of pattern that or a modified pattern that overcomes the limitations of what they were stuck in before. And I'll just give you another example, a social example, which was from the civil rights movement in the South before the rise of the direct action part with sit-ins and freedom rides and the Montgomery bus boycott. Before that, there was a very important civil rights movement, but one that did not use those kinds of tactics for the most part, that used the law and brought suits and tried to challenge inequality primarily through lawsuits. And this, it turns out, was a very important thing to do. And many of the key direct action struggles of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s actually were about implementing some of the things that had been won in law courts. So it's not, I'm not arguing that there's only one strategy or that direct action is the only kind of strategy that means anything. But nonetheless, the limitations of the legal strategy led especially young African Americans in the South to become, as they, it was said, impatient. And when are our rights going to come? And you, if you look at Martin Luther King's speeches and sermons, you'll see a lot, who was very young at this time, in his mid-20s, you'll find some of that impatience articulated. But it was, of course, much, much more widespread than that. And that was what led, for example, young students in southern cities to start the sit-ins and Woolworth's lunch counters. What led others to have the freedom rides, where black and white teams would board buses together in the North where it was legal. And then when they got to the Mason-Dixon line between the North and the South, they would be ordered that the blacks go to the back of the bus, and they all refused to move. And then they would all be arrested. Very often mobs would form and beat them up. And those confrontations, that creation of tension in the community, led to all kinds of mobilization of support, pressure on politicians who had black constituencies in the North, especially in the North, cities like Detroit, and where eventually led to what was already an established legal right for blacks to ride anywhere on interstate transportation, in the case of the Montgomery bus boycott, to ride anywhere on buses after about a year of boycott of the city buses. So that would be an example of people reflecting on the kinds of strategies they were using, not necessarily rejecting them totally, because one aspect of this way of thinking is often you change in order to preserve something that's important to you, or you try to preserve something even while you're trying to make change, or you use something that you already have in order to make change.
Like a law.
Like,
that's not being enforced.
Yeah, exactly.
For example, yeah.
Yeah. So, people reflecting on the limitations of the civil rights tactics prior to, let's say, the Montgomery bus boycott, came to feel that there was a need for another kind of action. They began, Sam, testing it out before the famous, for example, refusal to move by Rosa Parks in Montgomery. There actually had been other cases of African Americans refusing to move, refusing to go to the back of the bus and getting arrested for it in Montgomery, as well as in other places in the South. So it didn't spring without any testing and trying. That idea had sprung up a number of places and a number of people had tried it. It happened to actually be in a context where it could really take off with Rosa Parks. And yeah, that's why we identify that as the beginning of the movement.
So many examples like that, right? I mean, I remember being at protests on Wall Street where a couple hundred people showed up, got beaten by the police and left, you know, and it didn't turn into, you know, a movement, you know?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't the right time and tactic and whatever, but, you know, yeah.
Right. And then it raises another important point, which is, and it has to do with this feedback question. What you need to take from feedback is not, well, if something didn't work, forget about it.
Right.
You need to take, why didn't it work? What did work and what didn't work? You need a deeper, more complex way of looking at it.
What was the context at the time in society?
What was the context? Right. Could you create another context?
Yeah.
So Occupy Wall Street is a great example of this. It is definitely true that there have been many demonstrations like it, that attempts to do things like that, that just didn't go anywhere. It's also true that Occupy Wall Street, which was a huge, by historic standards, just enormous action that ended up having 600 other Occupy Wall Street centers around the country within a few weeks. And it was preceded by the Wisconsin uprising, which was not identical, but similar in many ways. And by the then there had also been a series in New York of sit-ins at City Hall that had been influenced by the Wisconsin uprising and led to a big but not very successful mobilization against the austerity budget that the mayor was trying to impose. But the people and the ideas from that struggle were very much what went into the formation of Occupy Wall Street. And the other piece to bring out here is that people think of, oh, Occupy Wall Street, well, it was just a flare-up and then it didn't really have any impact. A lot of the people who were involved in Occupy Wall Street, who had been extremely gung-ho for it and thought it was really the start of a new historic period, became very, very disillusioned. But they became too disillusioned because the genie was out of the bottle. The idea that inequality was a central aspect of American society, and that it was one that was making hundreds of millions of people's lives unlivable, and that there had to be a stand taken against it, and that it was being promoted by public policy, was there. It couldn't be suppressed again. And it's widely believed by political science types that part of the reason for Obama's electoral victory, presidential election, was because he adopted the rhetoric, the language of the Occupy Wall Street movement and said, inequality is the great new issue for American society. And the resonance that that had, because Occupy Wall Street had put it in the center of public discussion and in the center of public awareness, and had made the idea that maybe you could do something about it rather than, well, that's just the way things are, created a context in which that kind of change in other arenas could occur. So I think so,
Jeremy, there's a lot of other social movements you write about that I would love to mention, and that, you know, that we've both directly participated in and have lots of fond memories of. But I want to mention another character that you write about, who comes up not only in your book but in the lives of a lot of people over the past 170 years or so. You know, a guy who's had a fairly outsized influence on a lot of people, named Karl Marx. And I just, when you write about growing up in Communist Party circles among a lot of people who never read Karl Marx, and you never calling yourself a Marxist, but being one who actually has read Karl Marx, I just want to hear some reflections, because this is, I mean, even now, right now, you know, 30 years after the fall of the Soviet Union and whatever else, there's a whole, this whole, I mean, if you look at comments on my YouTube channel and a hell of a lot of other places in the world, online, wherever, you'll find raging debates going on between people who consider themselves, many of them young people, but people of all ages, you know, who are struggling with sort of ideological questions how to look at the world and history and coming up with theories a lot more than heuristics, I think, and it's very divisive in a lot of ways, and there are lots of pros and cons to the whole influence of Marx and Marxists. And I'm not asking you to try to sum all this up in the next few minutes, but can you take a little bit of a stab at that whole question? Would you?
I'll try.
Thank you.
There are three short chapters in Common Preservation in a Time of Mutual Destruction about Marx and about my trying to grapple with different aspects of Marx. And the first thing I would say is that I'm proud to say that I am tremendously influenced by Marx, that the whole way I think probably would be impossible without Marx, and that some of Marx's ideas are explicitly included in the Common Preservation heuristic. So that's for number one. For number two, there are serious problems with trying to take Marx as gospel, and is often referred to the guy as gospel, the Bible of the working class, it was once called. And many people act, unfortunately, with Marx as if it was a Bible, as if it was revealed truth, treat it in a very dogmatic form. And it's made worse by the fact that there was an official version of Marxism that was propagated by official communist parties that was very, if I can use the technical term that I think describes it, reductionist, that doesn't treat it as part of the effort we all go through to try to interpret society and understand what's going on, what it means, and what to do about it, but rather as a set of rules and principles and fixed positions. This is very, very alien to Marx's own way of thinking. He was constantly self-critical, constantly trying to move beyond his own established positions, and constantly trying to move back and forth between the theory that he had developed so far and the empirical information, the historical and contemporary reality that he was trying to go about understanding. So Marx, as somebody who was trying to put things together, I think we can learn an enormous amount from. Although there are certain things that I think are on the wrong track, and you can find out what they are if you read those chapters in Common Preservation. That is infinitely far from saying it's worthless. But Marx is famously quoted as saying, I at least am not a Marxist. When people dogmatically citing some writing of his to prove some point that he thought was completely on the wrong track.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The one other thing that I would say that is foundational for me, let's say, is that, and this goes back to Piaget, and some of the underlying ideas that I'm trying to make accessible in Common Preservation. At the core of Marx is, the Marx that I am find most valuable and important is the saying, philosophers have interpreted the world in various ways, but the point is to change it. And I think that the thing that makes Marx very different from most of the dogmatic efforts to interpret and use and expound and interpret and apply his writings and his thought is that idea of how do you change things and that action is at the core of knowledge. Very much for him. That's at the core, and it's at the core of the Common Preservation heuristics. It's also very much at the core of Piaget, and part of what I was trying to do with Piaget is take that idea of action as the core of knowledge and at the core of development and change, take those ideas and. I don't think they're contradictory with Marx's ideas, but I think Piaget develops them a whole lot in a way that it's neither Marxism nor non-Marxism, certainly not anti-Marxism, and he wrote quite positively about Marxism, but it is a development of those ideas in order to understand development more fully. And I see that as something that is a great development of things that Marx also made a major contribution to.
So everybody should read Common Preservation in an Age of Mutual Destruction, new book out on PM Press. But lastly, Jeremy, before talking to you, watching or listening to National Public Radio this morning, I heard The Antony Blinken, who was having a press conference, and with a straight face, he was talking about how China's foreign aid is all tied up in with all kinds of strings attached, and they're trying to basically enslave the world or something. And it just sounded so much like everything people have been saying about the IMF and the World Bank, but and how they attach strings to all their policies of loaning money, but he didn't make any reference to that, and it's shocking. But I wonder if you have any thoughts on that particular, if you happen to have caught that press conference, or any particular thoughts.
Well, I'm reminded of the phrase of the great radical Scottish poet Robert Burns, that he would the gift he give us to see ourselves. As others see us. It's true of us as individual human beings. It's true of us as groups. It's true of us as societies. Human beings are great, but they have some flaws. And the ability to see, as another person sometimes worth quoting, the ability to see the mote in your neighbor's eye, but not see the log in your own eye. Some of you may be aware, this is once a famous guy. He wandered around Nazareth around seeing a lot of very radical stuff. And I think for all of us, and perhaps the United States and the American people are a great exemplar of this, It would be a lot better if we could see ourselves as others see us, and if we could see the log in our own eyes.
Great advice. Thanks so much, Jeremy. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Great. Thank you. It's great to be able to go into things in this kind of depth.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, and we'll see you soon, I hope.
Great.
In the real world, even, perhaps.
Great.
Take care.
I look forward to being able to attend your concerts again.
That would be nice. Yeah, I'm vaccinated now, so I say I'm looking forward to frothing and spitting on the front row again. Take care. Great.
Okay.
And thanks, everybody, for joining this discussion with historian Jeremy Brecker, who has a wonderful new instructional and reflective book out on PM Press. Mutual common preservation in an age of mutual destruction in the time, right? No, I'm letting the title come by in an age. Okay. This has been Discussions with David. You can find this archived on youtube.com/drovix, or if you look it up on any podcasting platform, look for This Week with David Rovix, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to it. And we'll see you again soon somewhere on the web here. And if you're in Portland, Oregon, or anywhere near Portland, then please go to abolishevictions.org and join Portland Emergency Eviction Response. And I'll see you on the streets when we abolish evictions and control the rent. Remember, mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent unless you really have to, and trust your neighbors. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye for now.